Discourse on Metaphysics by G. W. Leibniz, first published in 1686. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Sections 14 through 25. 14. Now that we have some grasp of what the nature of substances consists in, I should try to explain their dependence on one another, and the active and passive aspects of their goings on. Well, firstly, it is very evident that created substances depend on God, who conserves them and indeed produces them continuously by a kind of emanation, just as we produce our thoughts. For God considers from every angle the general system of particular events that he has thought fit to produce, in order to manifest his glory, turning it on all sides, so to speak. And as he considers all the faces of the world in all possible ways, for no aspect escapes his omniscience, each view of the universe, as though looked at from a certain viewpoint, results in a substance that expresses the universe in just that way, if God sees fit to actualize his thoughts by producing such a substance. And as God's view is always correct, so too are our perceptions. Where we go wrong is in our judgments, which are our own. I said above, and it follows from what I have said here, that each substance is like a separate world, independent of every other thing except God. So all our phenomena, all the events that occur in us, are simply consequences of our being, of our nature. These events maintain a certain order in conformity with our nature, or with the world that is in us, so to speak. And this enables us to set up rules which we can use to guide our conduct, and which are justified by their fit with future events, so that often we can judge the future by the past, without falling into error. That would give us a basis for saying that these phenomena are veridical, that they tell the truth, without bothering about whether they are external to us, or whether others are aware of them too. Still, it emphatically is the case that the perceptions or expressions of all substances correspond with one another, in such a way that each one, by carefully following certain principles or laws it has conformed to, finds itself in agreement with others that do the same, as when several people agree to meet together in some place on a certain day, and succeed in doing so. For the states of substances ought to express the same phenomena, their expressions don't have to be perfectly alike. They need only to be correlated, just as a number of spectators think they are seeing the same thing, and do in fact understand each other, even though each one sees and speaks according to his point of view. Now it is God alone, from whom all individuals continuously emanate, and who sees the universe not only as they do, but also completely differently from them all, who is the cause of this correspondence in their phenomena, and brings it about that what is particular to one is public to all. Without that, there would be no connection among them. This gives us a basis for saying that no particular substance ever acts on or is acted on by another particular substance. The sense in which this is true is far removed from common usage, but it is good, nevertheless. Bear in mind that what happens to each substance is a consequence of its idea or complete notion and of nothing else, because that idea already involves all of the substance's predicates or events and expresses the whole universe. In reality, nothing can happen to us except thoughts and perceptions, and all our future thoughts and perceptions are only the consequences, contingent ones, of our preceding thoughts and perceptions. So if I could command a clear view of everything happening or appearing to me right now, I would be able to see in it everything that will ever happen or appear to me. And it would not be prevented, and would still happen to me, even if everything outside of me were destroyed except for God. But when we have perceptions of a certain kind, we think that they come from outer things acting on us. And I want to look into what this belief is based on, and what truth there is in it. 15. I needn't spend long on this. All I need just now is to reconcile what is said as a matter of metaphysics with what is said in everyday talk, which I do by saying that we reasonably attribute to ourselves the phenomena that we express more perfectly, and attribute to other substances what each of them expresses best. So a substance that expresses everything is in a metaphorical sense infinitely extended, but it comes to be limited by the more or less perfect manner of its expression. This gives us a notion of how substances obstruct or limit one another, and, consequently, we can say that in this sense they act on one another, and are obliged to address themselves to one another, so to speak. What follows is the reason why this way of speaking, though not correct as a matter of strict and basic metaphysics, is nevertheless reasonable, or right in its own way. It can happen that a change that raises the level of expression of one substance lowers that of another. Now, a particular substance has power in expressing well the glory of God, and in doing that it is less limited. And each thing, when it actively exercises its power changes for the better, and extends itself in proportion to how active it is. So when a change occurs that affects several substances, and actually all changes touch them all, I believe we can properly say that 1. That immediately passes to a higher level of perfection, or to a more perfect expression, exercises its power and acts, and 1. That passes to a lower level, shows its weakness and is acted on. I hold also that every action of a substance that has perception signifies some pleasure, whereas every passivity, every instance of being acted on, involves some sadness, and vice versa. It can easily happen, though, that a present advantage is destroyed by a greater evil later on, which is why we can sin when we are active or exerting our power and enjoying doing so. 16. My remaining task is to explain how it is possible that God should sometimes have influence on men or on other substances by an out-of-the-ordinary or miraculous concourse. This question arises because whatever happens to created substances is purely a consequence of their nature, which seems to imply that nothing extraordinary or miraculous can happen to them. Remember, though, what I said earlier about the place of miracles in the universe, that they always conform to the universal law of the general order, even though they override subordinate rules and are in that sense out of the ordinary. And since each person and each substance is like a little world that expresses the larger world, anything that happens within a substance belongs to the general order of the universe, which is, indeed, expressed by the essence or individual notion of that substance. Yet an extraordinary action by God on a single substance, though it does conform to the general order, can still be called miraculous. This is why, if we include in our nature everything that it expresses, nothing is supernatural to it, because it extends to everything, because an effect always expresses its cause, and God is the true cause of substances. But the powers and the limits of our nature come, as I have just explained, from the facts about what it expresses more perfectly, and for that reason what it expresses more perfectly belongs to it in a particular manner. Many things are beyond the powers of our nature, indeed of all limited natures. So in order to make this easier to grasp, I say that what marks off miracles and the extraordinary concourse of God is that they cannot be foreseen by the reasoning of any created mind, however enlightened, because no such mind can rise to having a clear view of the general order. On the other hand, everything that is called natural depends on less general rules that created things can understand. In order, then, to have not only meanings but words that are above reproach, it would be good if we linked certain modes of speech with certain thoughts in the following way. We can use our essence to stand for something including all that we express, however imperfectly. And in that sense, our essence has no limits and can rise to anything, because it expresses our union with God Himself. We can use our nature, or our power, to designate what is limited in us that is, to designate the more perfectly expressed fragment of all we express, and anything that surpasses the nature or power, in this sense, of any created substance is supernatural. 17. Having several times mentioned subordinate rules or laws of nature, I think it would be good to give an example. Our new philosophers standardly employ the famous rule that God always conserves the same quantity of motion in the world. This is indeed most plausible, and in days gone by I thought it to be beyond doubt. But I've since realized where the mistake lies. It is that Descartes and many other able mathematicians have believed that the speed at which a thing moves, multiplied by its size, exactly equals the moving force it exerts, or, geometrically speaking, that forces are directly proportional to speeds and bodies. Now it is rational that the same force should always be conserved in the universe. Here are reasons for the two halves of that thesis. As regards the addition of force, looking carefully at the observable facts, we can clearly see that perpetual mechanical motion doesn't occur, because if it did, the force of a machine, which is always slightly lessened by friction, and so must soon come to an end, would be restored, and consequently would increase of itself without any input from outside. As regards the loss of force, we also observe that a body's force is lessened only to the extent that it gives some of it to adjacent bodies, or to its own parts, insofar as they have their own independent motion. So the new philosophers were right about the conservation of force. Where they went wrong was in this. They thought that what can be said of force could also be said of quantity of motion, that is, speed. I am now going to show the difference between force and quantity of motion. In doing this, I shall make an assumption that a body falling from a certain height gains enough force to rise back up again if its direction carries it that way, unless it is prevented. For example, a pendulum would return exactly to its starting position unless the resistance of the air and other little obstacles didn't slightly lessen the force it had acquired. I shall also make this assumption, that raising a 1-pound body, A, to the height of 4 fathoms, requires as much force as is needed to raise a 4-pound body, B, to the height of 1 fathom. All this is accepted by our new philosophers. It is clear, then, that body A, having fallen 4 fathoms, has acquired exactly as much force as has body B, that has fallen 1 fathom. For body B, when it has completed its fall, has the force needed to climb back up to the start, by the first assumption, and so has the force to carry a 4-pound body, its own body that is, to the height of 1 fathom. And similarly, body A, when it has completed its fall, has the force needed to climb back to its start, and so has the force to carry a 1-pound body, its own body that is, to the height of 4 fathoms. Therefore, by the second assumption, the forces of these two bodies are equal. Let us now see whether the quantities of motion are the same on the one side as on the other. Here they will be surprised to find that there is a very great difference. For Galileo has demonstrated that the speed acquired in A's fall is double the speed acquired in B's, although the height is quadruple. Therefore, the quantity of motion of body A at the end of its fall is half that of body B at the end of its fall, yet their forces are equal. So quantity of motion is clearly different from force, QED. This shows how force should be calculated from the size of the effect it can produce, for example, by the height to which a heavy body of a particular size and type can be raised, which is very different from the speed it can reach. To double the speed, you must more than double the force. Nothing is simpler than this proof. Monsieur Descartes got this wrong, through putting too much trust in his thoughts, even when they were not properly mature. But I am amazed that his followers have not since recognized this mistake. They are, I am afraid, starting to resemble some of the Aristotelians whom they mock, getting into their habit of consulting their master's books, rather than reason and nature. 18. This point about how force differs from quantity of motion is of some importance, not only in physics and in mechanics, for discovering the true laws of nature and rules of motion, and indeed for correcting some practical errors that have glided into the writings of certain able mathematicians, but also in metaphysics for understanding its principles better. What follows illustrates the point about metaphysics. Motion, considered strictly in itself, consists merely in change of place, and it is not an entirely real thing. When several bodies change their relative positions, those changes in themselves do not settle which of the bodies should be said to have moved, and which to have remained at rest. But the force or immediate cause behind those changes has more reality to it, and there is an adequate basis for ascribing it to one body rather than to another, that being our only way to know which body the motion mainly belongs to. Now, this force is something different from size, shape, and motion, and this shows us that, contrary to what our moderns have talked themselves into believing, not everything that we can conceive in bodies is a matter of extension and its modifications. So here again, we have to reintroduce certain beings or forms that the moderns have banished. And it becomes more and more apparent that although all particular natural events can be explained mathematically or mechanically by those who understand them, the general principles of corporeal nature, and even the somewhat less general principles of mechanics, belong to metaphysics rather than to geometry, and have to do with certain indivisible forms or natures, as the causes of appearances, rather than with corporeal or extended mass. This line of thought could reconcile the mechanical philosophy of the moderns with the caution of some intelligent and well-intentioned people, who fear, with some reason, that we might be endangering piety by moving too far away from immaterial beings. In case that remark is too compressed, I shall now, down to the end of this section, amplify it. On the one hand, my position enables us to agree with the moderns that in scientifically explaining physical events, we can proceed as though we were materialists, appealing to nothing but material bodies and their properties. On the other hand, we are saved from outright materialism, and thus from the risk of sliding into atheism, which materialism brings with it, by my views about what is needed to complete the physics of bodies. I hold that the laws governing the behaviour of bodies involve a concept of force that cannot be extracted from the concept of body. So it is sheerly additional to anything the materialists are comfortable with, and it points in the direction of immaterial beings as what might contain or exert the forces. Also, I hold that after we have established all the laws of matter, there remains the question, why are these the laws of matter? And that the only tenable answer is, because God chose that they should be. 19. As I don't like to judge people harshly, I shan't make accusations against our new philosophers, who claim to expel from physics all final causes, purposes or goals, causes that pull. But still I can't deny that the consequences of this view seem to me dangerous. It is especially dangerous when it is combined with the view I refuted earlier in this work, which seems to eliminate purposes altogether, from theology as well as from physics, as if God acted without intending or aiming at any end or good. Against this, I hold that it is to final causes that we should look for the ultimate explanation of all existent things, and of the laws of nature, because God always aims at the best and the most perfect. I freely admit that we may go wrong in trying to work out what God's ends or purposes are, but that happens only where we want to limit them to some particular design, thinking he had only some single thing in view, whereas in fact he takes account of everything, all at once. So, for example, it is a great mistake to think that God made the world only for us, although it is true that he did make it, all of it, for us, and that there is nothing in the universe that does not touch us, and which is not also adjusted to fit his concern for us, in accordance with the principles I laid down earlier. So when we see some good effect or some perfection that happens or follows from the works of God, we can safely say that God intended it. We sometimes fail to act well, but not God. He doesn't do things by accident. This is why, far from risking exaggeration in this, like political observers who go to absurd lengths in attributing subtlety to the designs of princes, or like literary commentators who look for too much learning in their author, one could never overstate the complexity of thought that this infinite wisdom involves. On no subject do we run less risk of error, so long as we only make affirmations and avoid negative propositions that limit the designs of God. Everyone who sees the admirable structure of animals is led to recognize the wisdom of the Creator of things, and I advise those with any feelings of piety, and indeed of true philosophy, to avoid saying, as do certain self-proclaimed freethinkers, that we see because we happen to have eyes, but not that the eyes were made for seeing. If one seriously maintains these ridiculous views that hand everything over to the necessity of matter, or to some kind of chance, one will have trouble recognizing an intelligent author of nature. For an effect must correspond to its cause. Indeed, the best way to know an effect is through its cause. If you introduce a supreme intelligence as the organizer of things, it doesn't make sense to go on to explain events purely in terms of the properties of matter without bringing in the organizing intelligence. It would be as though, in explaining a great prince's victory in a successful siege, a historian were to say, "It was because the small particles of gunpowder, released by the touch of a spark, shot off fast enough to impel a hard, heavy body against the walls of the place, while the particles making up the strands of copper in the cannon were so densely interwoven that they were not pulled apart by that speed." Instead of showing how the conqueror's foresight made him choose the appropriate time and means, and how his power overcame all obstacles. 20. This reminds me of a beautiful passage by Socrates in Plato's Phaedo, which agrees splendidly with my views on this point, and seems to have been aimed straight at our over-materialist philosophers. This agreement made me want to translate it, although it is a little long. Perhaps this sample will stimulate someone to make available to us many other beautiful and solid thoughts to be found in the writings of this famous author. It is Socrates who speaks. "I once heard someone reading from a book that he said was by Anaxagoras, containing these words: 'All things were caused by an intelligent being that set them out and embellished them.' This pleased me greatly, for I believe that if the world was caused by an intelligence, everything would be made in the most perfect possible manner. That is why I believed that someone wanting to explain why things are produced, and why they perish or survive, should search for what would be most suitable to each thing's perfection. So such a person would only have to consider, in the thing he was studying, whether himself or something else, what would be the best or most perfect. For someone who knew what was most perfect would also know what would be imperfect, for the knowledge of either is knowledge of the other. Considering all this, I rejoiced at having found an authority who could teach me the reasons for things. For example, whether the earth is spherical or flat, and why it is better that it should be one way rather than the other. I expected also that in the course of saying whether or not the earth is at the center of the universe, he would explain to me why its position is the most suitable for it to have, and that he would tell me similar things about the sun, the moon, the stars, and their movements. And finally, that after having told me what would be best for each thing in particular, he would show what would be best overall. Filled with this hope, I lost no time in acquiring Anaxagoras's books and whipping through them, but I found nothing like what I had been reckoning on. To my surprise, I found him making no use of the idea of the governing intelligence that he had put forward, that he had nothing more to say about the embellishments and the perfection of things, and that he brought in an implausible notion of ether. It's as though someone were to say at the outset that Socrates acts with intelligence, and then moves on to explaining the particular causes of Socrates' actions thus. Socrates is seated here because he has a body composed of bone, flesh, and sinews. The bones are solid, but they are separated at joints. The sinews can be stretched or relaxed, and so on. Or as though someone wanting to explain our present conversation appealed to the air, and to the organs of speech and hearing, and such things, forgetting the real causes, namely, that the Athenians thought it better to condemn than to acquit me, and that I thought it better to remain here than to escape. If I had not had that thought, if I had not found it more just and honourable to suffer the penalty my country chooses to impose than to live as a vagabond in exile, I swear these sinews and bones would long ago have put themselves in foreign parts. That is why it is unreasonable to call these bones and sinews causes. Someone might say that without bones and sinews I could not do what I do, and he would be right. But the true cause is different from a mere condition without which the cause could not be a cause. Some people offer as their whole explanation of what holds the earth in its place the movements of bodies surrounding it. They forget that divine power sets everything out in the most beautiful manner, and do not understand that the right and the beautiful join forces to form and maintain the world. 21. Well now, since God's wisdom has always been recognized in the detail of the physical structure of certain bodies, especially animals and plants, it must also display itself in the general economy of the world, and in the constitution of the laws of nature. That is so true that this wisdom can be seen in the general laws of motion. Here is how. If there were nothing to a body but extended mass, and motion were only change of place, and if everything should and could be deduced with geometrical necessity from those definitions alone, it would follow, as I have shown elsewhere, that a tiny body, upon bumping into an enormous stationary body, would give it the same speed as it itself had, without losing any of its own. And a number of other rules which, like this one, are completely contrary to the formation of a system, would have to be admitted. But a system is provided by the decision of the divine wisdom to conserve always the same total force and direction. I even find that some natural effects can be demonstrated twice over, first through efficient causes that push, and then through final causes that pull, for example, by bringing in God's decision to produce his effect always in the easiest and the most determinate ways. I have shown this elsewhere, in explaining the rules of reflection and refraction of light, about which I shall say more presently. 22. It is good to point this out, in order to reconcile those who hope to explain mechanically how the parts of an animal are initially interwoven, and what machine they compose, with those who explain that same structure through final causes. Both are good, both can be useful, not only for admiring the great workman's ingenuity, but also for making useful discoveries in physics and medicine. Authors who go these different ways ought not to heap abuse on each other, as they sometimes do. For I see that those who focus on explaining the beauty of divine anatomy make fun of others who think that such a beautiful variety of organs could have come from a seemingly chance motion of certain fluids. They call such people rash and profane. The latter, on the other hand, call the others simple and superstitious, and liken them to the ancients, bringing the charge of impiety against the physical scientists, who maintained that thunder is produced not by Jupiter, but by some kind of matter in the clouds. It would be best to combine the two approaches, because, if I may use a down-to-earth example, I recognize and praise a workman's skill, not only by showing what designs he had in making the parts of his machine, but also by explaining the tools he used to make each part, especially when those tools are simple and cleverly devised. God is such a skillful worker that he could produce a machine 1,000 times more ingenious than those of our bodies, using only various quite simple fluids that were devised so that ordinary laws of nature were all it took to arrange them in the right way, to produce such an admirable effect. But that doesn't alter the fact that none of this would happen if God were not the author of nature. Explanations in terms of efficient causes are deeper, and in some way more immediate and more truly explanatory. But for the details of events, such explanations are hard to come by, and I believe that our scientists usually fall far short of achieving them. By contrast, the way of final causes is easier, despite which it often enables us to conjecture important and useful truths, truths that the other more physical route, that is, the way of efficient causes, would have taken ages to reach. Anatomy provides substantial examples of this. I also think that Snell, who first formulated the rules of refraction, would have taken a long time finding them if he had tried to come at them first by way of efficient causes, which would require him to discover how light is formed. Instead of that, he seemed to have followed the method the ancients used for reflection of light, which is, in fact, that of final causes. They looked for the easiest way to get a ray of light from one point to another by reflection in a given plane, assuming that this is the way nature was designed. And this led them to the discovery that the angle of incidence always equals the angle of reflection. Snell, I think, more ingeniously applied this to refraction. Descartes tried to demonstrate this same theorem in terms of efficient causes, but his demonstration is nowhere near as good, and there is room to suspect that he would never have found the theorem by his method if he had not been told in Holland of Snell's discovery through final causes. 23. I have thought it appropriate to emphasize a little the relevance to bodies of final causes, incorporeal natures, and an intelligent cause, so as to show that these have a role even in physical science and mathematics. I have wanted to do this because it may, on the one hand, clear contemporary physics of the charge of impiety that has been levelled at it, and, on the other, raise the minds of our philosophers from purely material considerations to thoughts of a nobler kind. Now it is appropriate to return from bodies to immaterial natures, and in particular to minds, and to say something about the means that God employs to enlighten them and to act on them. There is no doubt that here too there are certain laws of nature, which I will be able to discuss more fully elsewhere. Just now it will be enough to say a little about ideas, about whether we see all things in God, and about how God is our light. I should point out that many errors arise from the misuse of ideas. For example, some ancient and modern philosophers have based a very imperfect proof of God on the natural assumption that when we reason about something, we have an idea of it. The proof goes like this: I can think about God, so I have an idea of him. This idea involves his having all perfections. Existence is one of the perfections, therefore God exists. The defect in this is its first move. We often think of impossible absurdities, for example, of the highest speed, or of the largest number, and the ideas involved in such thinking are in a certain sense false, in contrast with true ideas of things that are possible. So we can boast of having an idea, that is, a true idea, of a thing only when we are assured of its possibility. So the above argument falls short. Still, it does at least prove that God necessarily exists if he is possible. That is a significant result, because it attributes to God something that is not true of other things. it is indeed an excellent privilege of the divine nature to need only its possibility or essence in order actually to exist. 24. To understand the nature of ideas better, I must say a little about the different kinds of knowledge. When I can pick a thing out from among others, but cannot say what marks it out from them, my knowledge of it is confused. In this way we sometimes know vividly, without having the slightest doubt, whether a poem or a painting is good or bad, because it has a certain je ne sais quoi that pleases or displeases us. But when I can explain the criteria I am going by, my knowledge is clear. An assayer's knowledge is clear like this. He can distinguish true from false gold by means of certain tests or marks that make up the definition of gold. But the clearness of knowledge is a matter of degree, because the notions entering into the definition usually need to be defined in their turn, and are known only confusedly. But when everything that comes into a definition or an item of clear knowledge is known clearly, right down to the primary notions, I call that knowledge adequate. And when my mind takes in, clearly and at once, all the primary ingredients of a notion, it has intuitive knowledge of it. This is very rare. Most human knowledge is only confused or suppositive. I shall explain this term in my next section. It is also worthwhile to distinguish nominal definitions from real ones. I call a definition nominal, i.e. verbal, when it fixes a word, but does not settle whether it is possible for any thing to be signified by it. When a definition shows that such a thing is possible, it is a real definition, where real comes from the Latin res, meaning thing. Now, as long as we have only a nominal definition, we can't be sure of the consequences that we draw from it, because if it conceals some contradiction or impossibility, it could also have opposing consequences. This is why truths don't depend on names, and are not arbitrary as some of the new philosophers have believed. A final point: real definitions differ considerably from one another. When possibility is proved only by experience, the definition is merely real and nothing more, as with the definition of quicksilver, which we know to be possible because we have encountered a fluid that is extremely heavy yet fairly volatile. But when the thing can be shown to be possible without help from experience, as when the definition shows how the thing could be generated, then the definition is both real and causal. And when a definition takes the analysis the whole way down to the primary notions without assuming anything that itself requires a proof of its possibility, the definition is perfect or essential. 25. Let us get clear about suppositive knowledge. When I think of 1,000, I often do so without contemplating the idea, as when I say that 1,000 is 10 times 100, without bothering to think what 10 and 100 are, because I suppose I know, and see no immediate need to stop to think about it. On those occasions, my thought that 1,000 is 10 times 100 is suppositive. In cases like that, I relate to the idea in the same way as I do in a thought in which there lurks an impossibility. Even if, in a given case, the relevant idea is all right, and doesn't involve an impossibility, I cannot learn that this is so by suppositive thinking. So it easily can, and quite often does, happen that I am mistaken about a notion that I suppose or believe I understand, when in fact it is impossible, or at least incompatible with the others to which I join it. And whether I am mistaken or not, this suppositive manner of conceiving is the same. End of sections 14 through 25.